Some of you who are really practiced at looking at these issues, there's value in seeing how the perspectives of those who participate in our institutions, like myself, calibrate with the views of political theorists about how those processes work, how they should work or do work. So I'm really pleased to be here this morning. My reflections are going to seek to highlight insights relating to my own experience of the bicameral process as a politician, and as I highlighted in my opening, to a remarkable extent, those experiences are similar for the Senate as they are to the Legislative Council. I've been a government backbencher in both the State Parliament of Western Australia in its upper house and now in the Senate, and I think that there are some quite typical things about that experience that hold true across both parliaments. So I know that political analysts are right to draw attention to the way in which the dominance of major parties influences senators so that they're focused on achieving the same ends as their lower house colleagues. And some people kind of see that as a challenge to the principles of bicameralism. And I think that this factor has really forced bicameral systems to evolve, and I note that in Western Australia, when and in the Senate, minor parties enjoy kind of the pointy ends of the debates, and that's probably a little bit different to parliaments like New South Wales, where because of the wider PR system, you've got a broader range of smaller party voices participating in that upper house review, as well as your party blocs. You've got a larger number of minority members, whereas in the West Australian Parliament we have a system that's not unlike the Senate. It's a regionalised PR system, and as a result of that you will get members elected from the major parties but also from the Greens, and historically we've also had One Nation. So there's a kind of a critical threshold where you don't get someone from the Shooters Party elected or no pokies. And to that extent, the experience of the Legislative Council in WA is quite like the Senate, in that you've got a prospect of parties like the Greens holding a balance of power. But I want to focus some of my remarks today on, I suppose, the implications of the different electoral mandates of senators and how they influence outcomes in the chamber through wider community debates and indeed internally in parties themselves. And I'm sure it's probably the same in the US. Those who are involved in the institutions who aren't, I suppose, members of political parties will look at it from that point of view of the houses not looking at each other. But if you're a Democrat or a Republican, whether you're in the Senate or in the Congress or whatever, you're all part of the same melting pot, and there's a lot of tangoing that goes on between those two forces and the electoral mandate that you have, whether you're elected to the Senate or within a House of Rep seat, influences the way those political parties conduct themselves. So I still firmly believe the current system does fulfil its intended purpose, and that's the principle of diffusing your kind of electoral majority and to mitigate the tyranny of the majority. And I suppose in political parties in Australia, that's kind of to some extent now done before the majority's even formed, in the sense that we're mitigating against some of that stuff in the debates in the party room. Now, I can see that stuff doesn't kind of happen often in public unless there's a leak, and it kind of has built. You get kind of some of that effect that actually takes place within the party room itself, I suppose, until it builds up like a bit of a dam, and then you've got your next test where. When that fails, then you hit your next set of accountabilities within the parliament and the media and our bicameral system. And so you've got kind of senators participating side by side with our lower house colleagues within those party forums. And I really think that that mandate that we have internally within the party is an important part of countering that, the kind of the tyranny of a simple majority. So in that sense, the impact of the Senate, and I suppose that's highlighted in the last discussion in relation to the question about ACT senators, is not just as it plays out publicly. Upper House members, I think, are now also universally used by both major and minor parties as an organising base, and in the process they help ensure that parties remain in touch with the views of lower house voters in seats that the party doesn't hold. And I don't know if that kind of activity takes place in the US as well. I'm sure that those kinds of links there are made too. But I know that that's probably certainly not as it was traditionally envisaged. They also provide the capacity for the party of government to connect with minorities from within government. It's probably not as transparent as systems like the list system in New Zealand, where they're doing that quite explicitly. But for people like myself, who came into politics as a gay and lesbian rights community activist, it's quite natural, I think, that I found my place, a path into the upper house of the state parliament rather than a lower house seat. And that's not to say that there aren't plenty of people who are gay or lesbian who've sought pre-selection in lower house seats and been successful, but they probably haven't been at the pointy end of those political debates in the way that I have been historically. You can also see this reflected in the different roles that people take within a party, as well as the kinds of people who get pre-selected. So it can be quite different in terms of the kind of person that is pre-selected within for a Senate seat versus a lower house seat. And I certainly acknowledge that that can have quite significant union interests, for example, within the Labor Party. You could see, for example, in Australia we've had some recent debates about ABCC, which is the watchdog on the building industry. And I personally think there are some very harsh and unjust laws attached to the ABCC. But the way those issues have been raised, you'll have noted that we've had some kind of spikes in media interest when senators have raised, in particular we've had senators raise those issues, and we've had a government that's firmly been saying this is our government policy and we're going to stick to it until 2012, and you've got senators who come from that union base saying it's not good enough, we really want to get these laws rid of them sooner rather than later. Now, that particular dynamic wouldn't be taking place unless you had senators with that kind of party and union mandate, which people have voted for, so it's still a democratic mandate, and I wouldn't disconnect that, as some people I think are prone to doing, because they're there by virtue of the electoral support that the party has received. So those kinds of factors interplay into political debates quite significantly, I think. I think Peter Van Onselen wrote an issue, a paper in 2004, which highlights some of those kinds of issues. And those experiences hold true for me in the Legislative Council of Western Australia as they do in the Senate. I just might grab a glass of water if that's okay. It's notable to me that upper house MPs have often pushed along issues, these are major party MPs, that aren't as connected to lower house issues or lower house constituencies and regional interests. And they do this not only within parliamentary forums and the community, but also in party forums, and it's the different kinds of advocacy that people do attach to their roles, I think, deserves looking at. I've noticed that lower house MPs often have strong commitments and interests in those same issues, but but they play out differently by virtue of our different constituencies and houses. Sometimes that's a factor of time. It's a factor of the kinds of constituency groups that you spend time meeting with, and they tend to be more geographically based as a lower house MP. And it's notable that upper house members pick up different roles than their lower house colleagues within political parties, whether they be power brokers and those rewarded by factions, but also, I suppose, those, because to some extent they depend on their pre-selections from the party base, they also tend to be people who build up leadership roles within the parties more often than lower house members do. And notably, the parties rely on a significant level of campaign experience, and we're talking about campaigning in lower house seats. As an upper house member, we don't run our own Senate campaign in a major party, whether it's the Legislative Council of WA or the Australian Senate. The focus really is on our contribution to winning government and to the energy and resources, therefore, you're putting in to help your lower house comrades win their seats. And by virtue of that, you're guaranteeing your own election. So we're not out there in the same way that, say, the Greens are in terms of campaigning as a Senate team. And I think that is quite significant. So in taking two to tango, I think it's really important that both Senators and House of Reps members kind of to look at the way we're in the mix internally in the ALP, and I'm sure in different ways in the coalition, and how this is an effect of our bicameral structure of Parliament. As I said earlier in my remarks, there have been different starting points for our state bicameral parliaments and Commonwealth Parliament, but it's clear to me how philosophically and practically aligned they are. Now, that's you can see that in terms of the structure of the parliament, but you can also see that in the way that political parties respond and use them. And there's quite a bit of alignment there in terms of my experience, as in terms of the similarities of my role as a state backbencher and now as a federal backbencher. I'm going to go on to matters that are, I suppose, are a bit more parliamentary, and acknowledge what is affectionately termed in WA the Clark's Party. I'm not sure if it's known as that here as well. And I suppose to those dedicated to holding up the traditions of bicameralism, despite the legitimate and illegitimate attempts of political parties to subvert them. And I remark with a real sense of good humour and deja vu on about the recent debates that we've had nationally about pensions. It was just so similar to the myriad of standoffs between the WA Legislative Council and the lower house on a myriad of bills initiated with funding implications. And they were sent by the Legislative Council only for the lower house to have them rot on the notice paper. And I've now witnessed Harry Evans defend the right of the Senate to pass such bills, just as I did witness Laurie Marquet do so often in WA. And again, with the government leadership in the upper house, taking not the view of the house, but the view of the government in the lower house. In my view, bicameral processes do work best when both sides respect the nature and scope of each other's roles. And in this, I don't simply mean a respect for constitutional conventions. I have to say, frankly, I neither agree nor disagree with the clerk's position on this one. And I know that's heresy to some. But for me, the constitutional question is actually not the real issue. Because with the exception of blocking supply, the business is in the hands of each chamber. And that means in the reps as well as in the Senate. And it's up to each chamber to do what it wants with the business that's before it. So, yes, I understand why the government sought to argue the pensions bill was unconstitutional, but I don't personally believe that it's the strongest argument against it. The question to me isn't whether such bills can be moved. The question is whether they should be moved. And to my mind, delivering a budget is a holistic process. And you can't have a bicameral process where you're holding a government to account for that budget, as a bicameral parliament needs to do, if you go around initiating bills with profound budgetary implications that are not government bills. It just makes a mess of the budget process, and I suppose of that holistic sense of government when you're trying to prosecute them for to be an accountable government in terms of what they deliver in the budget. If it was something routinely done by Senates for an upper house chamber to pass that kind of legislation with those profound budgetary implications, what would that mean for the whole process in terms of executive government? So the Senate's role is not to make budgets, but to ensure proper oversight of budgets. The two roles are only compatible if you're not kind of the Senate's there not trying to make the budget. You can't make something and independently review it, in my view. And I'd be interested, though, to have a conversation with people about that and find out what other people's opinions are on that particular issue. But the threshold question is not, I think, the constitutional nature of it, but really the premise that each chamber will decide what it does with its own business, and really the philosophical underpinnings of how you're trying to put accountability into that process. So I'm going to now move on to a few remarks about committees. And I've often heard it said how great Senate committees are, and they are, and I agree, and there are lots of things that I'm learning from the Senate committee process that I think are improvements on my experiences at a state level, but it's not in all cases the case. When they're allowed to work well, committees are great. I've seen significant outcomes with genuine bipartisan results. I saw this to great effect in looking at same-sex law reforms recently, where a bipartisan recommendation led to government-initiated amendments to a government bill. So there can be many reasons why committee work can be required. Issues need further consideration because they're not controversial. They need further scrutiny because insufficient attention has been paid to them. And other times there are genuine controversies and genuine confusion about the possible options open for resolution. However, we do need to look at our committee processes as we do all our parliamentary processes. And I think I don't know that senators even know that they're doing this, but I do think we don't always tend to respect the committee processes internally as much as we should. And that's a two-way street for all senators and not just a responsibility of government senators. For example, you did hear Senator Payne talk about the large number of referrals that she took on the Legal and Con Committee last year. But I want to say, if committees are overburdened with purely political references, with short reporting timelines, they don't have the time to do their work properly. And I want to compare and contrast here some of my experiences at a state level with at a federal level. I have found at a state level we had far more focused deliberative processes internally in the committee than has been my experience in the Senate thus far. It is reflective of the pace of Senate committee work, which has certainly been commented on already, and that the large number of issues that Senate committees are dealing with. For example, the Economics Committee's currently got 12 references before it. I'm doing my best to get my head around all of them, but I think it's only obvious that some of those issues are going to go by the wayside. And I think it's actually important to look at the culture of deliberative processes that we have in our committees, because in all likelihood the first deliberative discussion that will take place in a Senate committee will be the chair's draft report, and the political parameters are already drawn before there's any debate, and therefore buy-in from other political parties can, I think, be less likely, which is not the intention of a Senate, of a committee. I don't think that's kind of universally the case, but I think the likelihood of there being a political outcome in terms of there being a minority report and the seeking to have a partisan outcome to the committee's inquiry is made more likely by that process. I think media space can be swamped by too many references, and it reduces the leverage provided by a good, meaningful report. You can actually have really great recommendations that need to be adopted. Sometimes that'll be recognised by a minister or the government, but sometimes actually there's not enough pointy end between what the report says and the government's obligation to do something about that report. I thought I might also comment on the issue of privilege. In my experience, privilege within the state parliament is much tighter than it is at a federal level. And I think for a number of reasons, that's kind of because you've got a broader cohort of participating members in a Senate committee, whereas the state committees will substitute someone on, but you don't have broader members participating in the discussions. You also have that kind of process of the chair's report coming out before there's been much deliberative discussion about the report, and I think that that has some implications for privilege as well. It's also kind of the pace of the work that you're doing. It's actually almost impossible to get your head around all of the issues solely relying on the research support that you get from the Secretariat, and you're therefore very likely to have discussions with staff and other people. So it's really quite easy to see how what is purportedly a privileged discussion actually gets caught in a wider net. And I'm not necessarily saying that privilege is breached, but it's just kind of a much broader interplay of participants. Finally, I think Labor needs to reassess some of its somewhat incoherent views about upper houses. I suppose historically these views have been a response to the overrepresentation of conservative forces as a result of undemocratic processes such as property franchises or government appointments. It's also as a result of the scarring effect of the dismissal and it's prolonged Labor's hostility, I think, to upper houses as a bastion of conservative forces. And I think as a result of this history, and it's true for the Labor Party in both the state of WA and I think nationally, we're being ultra-democratic in Labor terms, and it's a winner-takes-all philosophy where the majority gets to rule outright, unfettered by constitutional constraints and other interests because it's our mandate to do so. However, recent experience of Conservatives controlling both houses has brought home, I think, to Labor the danger of systems without checks and balances. And again, now in WA, we're looking at a Conservative-controlled lower house and upper house, although I think to some extent the lower house will be more unstable than the upper house. So Labor in government needs to be accepting of the importance of the role played by bicameral systems in ensuring accountability and fair consideration, I think, of complex issues of government. We need to be focused, I think, not on whether they work, but on how they can work best to protect minority interests and enable diverse forms of representation to flourish within our parliaments, within our political parties, and within our broader community. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator. I was given some biographical notes yesterday on our next speaker, and it became immediately clear to me that Michael Baum has been unable to hold a job. He has been a finance journalist and author, a TV panelist, a radio commentator, a broker and public company director, a diplomat, a tribunal member, a consultant, and a regular columnist in the Australian Financial Review. He served as parliamentary secretary for the Treasury, held various shadow ministry positions, I understand, and served, and perhaps I should say survived, 5 years as Australia's Consul General in New York. For his services, he has been awarded the Order of Australia and also received a medal from the U.S. Foreign Policy Association for his contribution to improving U.S.-Australian relations. And a very subtle note, you will notice the flag pin on his right lapel. But what I found most intriguing is that he is also a member of the Council of the Sydney Symphony Orchestra and has written a book on the building of the Opera House. So I think on that last note alone, he deserves our approbation and our welcome.
Thank you. Perhaps I should also mention that I'm a director of the U.S. Studies Centre, which was allocated not to the ANU but to Sydney University. I am here, I guess, as a representative of those powerful conservative forces that we've just heard about. But I'm also here in a different sort of role, and that is, having been both in the House of Representatives and the Senate, not concurrently, I am, I suppose, living proof of that old comment that there is a life after political death, and it's in the Senate. But I want to say that I am a great fan of the Senate, particularly when it is used effectively and sensibly, in other words, when it agrees with what I do. But I recognise the validity of some quite strong criticism of the Senate. However, I want to say this. Whenever I hear people talking about reform of the Senate, I reach for my cast-iron underpants. Quite frankly, the word reform is no more than a synonym for change. And all change isn't necessarily for the better. And can I say some of the changes that have taken place in the Senate, or to the Senate, have been to the advantage of the democratic process, have been in the best interests of the people of Australia, but can I say so much change is motivated by self-interest that self-interest and the public interest only coincidentally exist together in the same activities. Now, the key thing that I want to stress is it is, to my mind, not the forms of the Senate that dictate its quality. It's the nature of the senators and how they behave within that structure. Now, it is accurate to claim that over its history, an enormous proportion of the Senate has been made up of time servers and retired, union apparatchiks, and on the other side, people whose sense of independence makes it very difficult to, in fact, have a, quotes, disciplined, unquote, party approach. So, on this question, one should note that when the coalition is in power, the volume of people who cross the floor is incredible in the Senate. There have been something like 150 floor crossings in the last 50 years. I admit 150 of them were from one Tasmanian senator, Reg Wright, and another 130 were from a Queensland senator. His name is Ian Wood. But the reality is that the Senate cannot be simply categorised as a place of incredibly competent review, nor can it be properly categorised as a house of discipline and party politics being dominant. As John Howard quite appropriately remarked after the 94 election, when the media said, the government now has control of the Senate, he said, no, 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 we have a majority. A big difference, as Barnaby Joyce would explain to you. Now, the big question is whether the structure of the Senate, in fact, enables a, if you like, a disproportionate extent of power to people that is far beyond their minuscule electoral support. I point out at the moment that a fellow who has, 2% of the vote from Victoria has the power to deny government legislation. Now, that may be a good thing, it may be a bad thing. I think it's worth recognising, though, that the Senate has the capacity to be, quote, unrepresentative, and in fact its very nature is unrepresentative. Why should a Tasmanian's vote be 10 times the value of a vote in New South Wales for the Senate? Because I got elected, thank you God, for New South Wales as a senator, with something like 10 times the vote that it takes to elect a Tasmanian senator because of the population difference. Now, quite frankly, I'm not really concerned about those sort of things. I'm a pragmatist. I'm concerned about outcomes. And the big question is that we should recognise the reality that a lot of the support and argument in favour of the Senate overstates it, and the great bulk of the criticism of the Senate is overstated as well. Now, I want to go back to this question of the quality of the Senate, because that is the issue. As John Faulkner said this morning, there was no legislative change, no constitutional change that brought about the creation of the Senate committees that have been absolutely vital in restoring what had been, I have to say, a fairly faded reputation of the Senate. I mean, in the bad old days, it was a winner-takes-all method of election, and based on alphabetical order. So the Labor Party, for example, would put up in New South Wales three candidates called Amor, Ashley and Armstrong. And that was the way the Senate was filled. Now, there have been massive changes in the Senate to its advantage. The only change that I think is arguable about whether it's to its advantage or not is 1984. Now, 1984 was a very important year as far as I'm concerned. I'd been beaten in 1983 for my House of Representatives position. And in the 1984 election, the Hawke government decided to increase the size of the House of Representatives and concurrently requiring the size of the Senate to increase. This, by the way, is one of those occasions in which the National Party crossed the floor in a block to vote with the government, because that was the only way they considered they could save their existence, because they'd be increasing the number of seats while they were busily losing seats in the rural sector. Now, that 1984 election was important, increased the size of the Senate, and therefore gave me an opportunity to be resurrected as a senator. On the other hand, what did it do to the nature of the Senate? Now, in the good old days when there were 10 senators from each state, every election would generally result in each state ending up with a majority one way or another, depending on the vote. Because if there are 10 senators and 5 to be elected at each election, you don't get an even split when you elect 5 senators. When you have 6 senators coming up for election, you have the prospect of there being no majority. In other words, the Howard temporary majority in the last term was an aberration. Now, maybe people think having a majority is an aberration that we can do without. Maybe it's not a good idea to have a majority in the Senate. We survived for the great bulk of 100 years while having a majority for the great bulk of that time. Harry would probably know how many occasions the government lacked a majority in the Senate. But the big question is, to what extent has that change destroyed the capacity of the government to implement its legislation without interference from minority parties, special interest groups, and to what extent does that provide the opportunity for political blackmail, which Senator Brian Harradine, and I commend him for his skill, was able to employ? Now, Brian managed to get more for Tasmania because of his, at one stage, balance of power position. And whether or not that was in the best interests of Australia overall is a question that one can examine. The fact is, he recognised that once his particular position as the balance of power ended, he recognised that by putting a feather duster in his office window in Parliament House, because he had, of course, lost that particular position. Now, the big question is whether or not the costs and benefits, I mean, this is the real issue, are the costs and benefits of having the Senate the way it is, when you add them up, does it come out in favour of the Senate or against it? Now, all I'm saying to you is that I think a lot of the discussion about the role of the Senate is so emotionally involved as to end up in hyperbole rather than reality. In my view, there is a clear burden of benefit in favour of the Senate. But that doesn't mean I'm blinded to what it can often be, in my view, quite disgraceful political blackmail. I mean, I can remember and Andrew Murray's not here, and I might say, by the way, in terms of the quality of the members, Murray was one of the best senators I think we've had in recent years. And I must say, Maurice Payne, I also have a very, very high regard for. There are some in the Senate for whom I have very little regard, who are indolent time servers, and who, quite frankly, are there as a reward for services elsewhere rather than what they can contribute to the government, to the Parliament and to the people of Australia. I got diverted by my excitement about what a good Senator Andrew Murray was. But this quality of the Senate and the capacity for blackmail reminds me of the situation when Chris Puplik was our shadow minister for the environment. And the government, the then Labor government, had brought in some legislation. We decided in shadow cabinet that we would move an amendment, that Public would move an amendment, which was straight down the line of stated Democrat policy. He went and discussed it with the leader of the Democrats. It was agreed that they would second the and speak in support of the amendment in the committee stages because it was straight down their policy line. Public gave a powerful piece of purple prose in the committee stages and said, and now my friend and colleague in the Democrats will speak in support of it. And the friend and colleague in the Democrats got up and said, well, actually, no, we're going to vote with the government on this issue because the government has agreed that they will appoint someone, one of their nominees, to the board of whatever it was, this thing that was being created, and we will ignore what our policy is. This was all said in much more obscure language. Yes, we will abandon our policy position because we're being paid off in another way, simply summarises the situation. Public then, and I commend him for it, then got up and said, Mr. Chairman, it is wrong for people to say that the Democrats can be bought. In fact, they can only be leased by the hour. And this may explain one of the reasons for the rise and fall of the small special interest parties who come and go, some distinguishing themselves by the capacity to employ political blackmail, and others by their capacity to keep their former colleagues out of government, like the DLP. Now, this might be one of the reasons, but only one of them, that the House of Representatives simply doesn't understand the Senate, and never has. I think probably their attitude is encapsulated by our former Prime Minister, one of our former Prime Ministers, Paul Keating, who described the Senate, I admit it was after one of my speeches about his piggery, but he described the Senate as unrepresentative swill, which I presume indicates that the House of Representatives is representative swill. But thank you for that. That's kind. The fact is, the Senate is, quotes, unrepresentative, unquote, in the sense that a Tasmanian vote is worth 10 times a New South Wales vote. But I'm certainly not one of those people who wants to change it. And can I say the committee system, we've already heard from John Faulkner, the committee system is outstanding. Most members of the Senate respond well to the search for the best solution in committees. I mean, we had one senator, and you have many skills across a whole range, but one senator, a former senator, John Watson, had a remarkable knowledge of the Tax Act, and the number of occasions he, from the opposition backbench, would effectively force corrections to intricate tax legislation is quite remarkable. Now, he, I must say, tended to be an exception, but the exceptions make the Senate worthwhile. Now, I suppose I'm special pleading. I must admit I took the view that when I went into the Senate, that all the governmental reports that were coming out, which provided a great opportunity to test the executive, were just being tabled in the Senate and nothing was being done about them. And there were marvellous opportunities to really point out how the executive had, quotes, blundered, unquote, particularly, I might say, the Auditor-General's repeated reports, which would tend to go unremarked, and there was no capacity to, in fact, deal with them other than instantaneously as they were tabled when you hadn't had the opportunity to read them. Now, as a former journalist, I never wished to be confused with the facts and would comment without having the capacity to, in fact, read the report, except during the tabling process, like 30 seconds. But nonetheless, one could extemporise quite effectively and at least get on the record the fact that the Auditor-General had been critical of the government in a particular respect. Now, in my view, and I understand, by the way, that the examination of reports over recent years has diminished since I left. Maybe the reports have been much more favourable because of the politicisation of the bureaucracy, who knows. But I must say the fact remains that it's the quality of the representatives who are in the Senate rather than the particular forms that dictate the quality of the Senate's activities. I think I've gone on far too long, but I want to make a couple of brief points. Firstly, there is a massive difference between the nature of debate in the House of Representatives, and I speak as having been a member of both, and the Senate. The House of Representatives is basically simply a theatre and not much more. Debates there are to put on the record the case for and, on occasions, the case against proceeding down a particular course, or opportunities for political set pieces. They are not there to influence themselves. They are there to state a case publicly for those who give a damn of the public. In the Senate, debates may often be absolutely meaningful to the outcome of the legislation. And debates also provide the opportunity for committee reports, which may be critical of the legislation, to be sensibly discussed. Now, one of the problems is that the new Parliament House is a lousy Parliament. Wonderful public building, sensational. And there are positives. I mean, the fact that the members and senators no longer have to use communal dunnies means that a lot of conspiring no longer takes place in the communal dunny. Instead, you conspire in secret in your room. But my basic complaint about this is the way it's affected the nature of debate. Now, in the old chambers, there was often whimsical, pleasant interjection. I blame the late Billy Snedden. It seems to me that the new chambers were designed deliberately to ensure that you could not be heard unless your microphone was on. It reduced the tension for the speaker or president. Now, it's very hard to make a whimsical, entertaining interjection or a friendly interjection when you have to shout it to be heard. And yet the chambers have sound absorbent cloth around them. The sound goes up like that or sideways. In the old chambers, they were wood panelled. You could hear, you could relate to each other, sometimes unpleasantly, but at least there was the opportunity for the whimsical people some of the famous associations of friendly witticisms in the Parliament, I think, have not existed in the new chambers for a simple technical reason. Anyway, I should finish by saying there have been some suggestions about changing the nature of the Senate. And as I say, while I avoid the word reform, it seems to me that there probably are some better ways of dealing with Senates that knock back legislation. And a former Labor Attorney General, Lavash, had proposed that after each election, legislation that had been knocked back twice by the Senate may well come before, say, a joint sitting of both houses, without, in fact, getting rid of the marvellous threat that exists of a double dissolution. I mean, I think there must be no attempt to get rid of this mutual threat where the Senate has the capacity, by knocking things back twice, to at least, I suppose, provide the government with an opportunity of threatening to take all the Senate out. Governments are reluctant to do that because it gives minor parties a greater opportunity of getting seats, because they only need to get half the size of the normal quota. So, I think this mutual threat involved is one of the things that should exist. But I finish on the point that there is no doubt that the great bulk of Senate activity is to the advantage of the people of Australia. There are many occasions where I think it's probably been to their disadvantage. I think the watering down of the GST to make it complicated was not in the best interests of the people of Australia. I think that some of the defence of the Senate against what was described extraordinarily as a nail in the coffin of the Senate's capacity to hold the government to account. That was when the Howard government decided to cut in half the number of Senate committees, where the previous government, which had been in a minority at the time in the Senate, had agreed, because of the force of circumstance, to split its committees into reference and legislation committees. Now, when the Howard government got a majority, it said, look, let's go back to the old system. One of the reasons being that the new system was being corrupted. In other words, there were 47 references of legislation, which is supposed to go to the legislation committee, which had government majority. Instead of that, they were being referred to the reference committees. A political stunt. Now, Harry Evans was jumped up and down about that, and I think he was wrong. Another fellow called Evans, who's now a senator, was the fellow who said this is a nail in the coffin of the Senate's capacity to hold the government to account. Surprisingly, now he is in a ministerial position where he can reverse that. He has shown no intention of doing so. Which I suppose just reminds us that the Senate is made up of politicians. The other person who had got excited about it, and we haven't heard anything more along these lines, is Steve Lewis from The Australian, who called it another brazen effort to stifle the voices of dissent. And yet the previous system had worked during the great bulk of the Hawke era. No one complained that involved stifling of dissent. And so, basically, I suppose my message is this. Look, take all the argument in favour of the Senate with a grain of salt. Take all the argument against the Senate with a grain of salt. And remember this net benefit. And have a look at Queensland, where there is no upper house. And as a consequence, Joe Jolke-Peterson could save the public a lot of money by very rarely calling the lower house to sit. I think 18 days a year was their average. The absence of an upper house is, in my view, a threat to democracy.
A lot of food for thought, a lot of ammunition for discussion. I'll simply respond to some of your comments comparing old Parliament House and new Parliament House by reminding those here today that about a month ago, I think, John, 2 months ago, there was a program sponsored by the Parliamentary Studies Center on Parliament and architecture and on the plans and the thinking behind the construction of new Parliament House. And I think if you go to the Parliamentary Studies website, you will find both some of the presentations and a précis of what occurred at that program. And now for something completely different. The third member of our panel, Harry Evans, has devoted, I was about to say his life, perhaps I should just say his professional life, to the service of the Senate. He could be called the conscience of the Senate, the defender, the advocate of the Senate, and he is this year celebrating his 20th year as clerk of the Senate of Australia. He is my friend. He has been my very gracious host during all of my visits to Canberra, so I'm delighted to turn the floor over to Harry Evans.
Well, thank you, Stan, and this is my opportunity to contradict something that Stan said, and it's often said that I'm a defender of the Senate. Actually, I'm not. I'm a defender of constitutional constraints, and it just so happens that the Senate is the one manifestation of that constitutional constraint that we have in our system of government. Well, my task is to get us back onto the topic, Michael Baum having led us far away from it. I was never able to do this when he was in the Senate, and nor was anybody else, for that matter, when he was in the Senate, but let me attempt to do so now and get back to the topic of bicameral relations between the houses. I've always said that there's no such thing as relations between the houses at the federal level in Australia. The negotiations and disputes that are conducted are always between the non-government parties in the Senate and the government. You can say that that is between the Senate and the government because it's always a Senate majority and the government, but you never have a situation where the House of Representatives as a body is expressing some view or taking some position vis-a-vis the Senate. It is always the government, and it's a case of contest between the Senate and the government, and that, of course, is a product of the very tight government control over the House of Representatives, which is always exercised. I was going to demonstrate this with a little account of the recent matter of the age pension bill. Senator Pratt has somewhat taken the wind out of my sails by admitting that it was all about political principle and not about the constitutional issue. But I was going to, in any case, start by saying that. Obviously, glaringly obvious to everybody who observed this, that the purpose of the non-government parties in passing the bill was to put pressure on the government and to bring political embarrassment to the government, and the purpose of the government in rejecting the bill out of hand was to avoid that political embarrassment to the maximum possible extent. And the existence of a claimed constitutional difficulty was, of course, a gift to the government to be able to reject the bill on that basis without having to deal with the merits of it. I've discovered over many, many years that if a government can say a measure is unconstitutional, perhaps, or there's some legal problem with it, perhaps, or there's some drafting problem with it, there's some problem with the drafting, they will always resort to those arguments rather than to deal with the merits of the measure before them. And I've lost count of the number of times when non-government senators have come into my office and said the government says it's unconstitutional, or the government says there are legal difficulties, or the government says there are drafting problems with this bill. And I always say to them, yes, yes, they always say that. They always say that. Actually, there aren't. But this is a device to avoid dealing with the merits of the proposition. But leaving all that aside, let me try to demonstrate my thesis that there are no such thing as bicameral relations by three observations about the pensions matter. The first observation is that this dispute could only come about because the Constitution says the Senate won't pass a bill, initiate a bill appropriating money. That would be very, very clear if bills that appropriated money clearly did appropriate money for the purpose of the bill. The reason for the dispute on this occasion was that there was already in existence an Act of Parliament going back many, many years, which already appropriated the money for all future increases in pensions, regardless of how much they were or what sort they were, and for all time. A provision in an Act which says whatever pensions cost and whatever all entitlements cost under the Social Security legislation, the money is hereby appropriated, unlimited amount and for all time. What sort of Parliament would pass an Act like that? One of the primary functions of Parliament is to grant money and to use that grant of money to hold the executive government accountable. What sort of Parliament would give that? Would give the executive government that sort of blank cheque to say, whatever you want to spend on this, you've got it forevermore, unlimited amount, a real blank cheque. Well, this Parliament has given the government over 400 of those blank cheques. In other words, 400 statutes which say whatever this costs, the money is appropriated here and now for all time, an unlimited amount. No Parliament worthy of the name would have allowed 400 of those statutes to be passed. Obviously, those statutes have been passed because it's very, very convenient for government. It's very convenient for government to have the money appropriated for all time, an unlimited amount, and not to have to worry about getting parliamentary approval for the actual amount of money for something. Now, obviously, the accumulation of those statutes over the years has been a product of executive government control of the parliament, sometimes of only one house often of both houses. The parliamentary power to grant supply has been totally corrupted by those sorts of acts to suit the convenience of governments of the day. And there are a lot of other little devices in the financial system which governments of the day have put in place over many years by little clauses in statutes, which virtually mean that governments now have unlimited amounts of money which they can spend any way they like, which they can shuffle around any way they like, and really don't need parliamentary approval for any of it. And that has been a product of, as I say, government control of the Parliament. A few months ago, the Senate Finance and Public Administration Committee looked at the financial system and made a whole series of recommendations for changes to it. And our distinguished speaker at the former panel, former Senator Andrew Murray, was asked by the current government when they were in opposition to do a report on how the financial system could be improved. And so far, both of those reports have disappeared without trace. Government has not responded to them. But I'm now following the bad example of Michael Bowen getting off the subject. Back to the pensions bill and bicameral relations. The three interesting things about the dispute about the pensions bill, special appropriations I've mentioned. The government said it had advice that it was not constitutional for the Senate to pass this bill. We have never seen that advice. Again, I've lost track of the number of times non-government senators have come into my office and said the government has got advice that this is not constitutional or not legal. And I've said, well, where is the advice? Good question. Let's read it and see what it says before we can make a judgment on it. Very often it's not revealed. I have discovered again over many, many years that advice given by government legal advisers and by others involved in advising the government invariably supports the political view of the government of the issue at the time. It's an amazing coincidence that advice to government never goes against the political interest of the government in the issue under consideration. The government wants to reject this pensions bill. Lo and behold, the advice says the pensions bill is unconstitutional. That has been the case, so far as I know, without exception over many, many years. An amazing feat. Occasionally things get into courts and then governments are embarrassed by courts rejecting the advice, but that doesn't seem to change the habit of government advisers. But the final thing about the pensions debate, which I mentioned, is that the Speaker, having presented a statement saying it's very doubtful whether the Senate can constitutionally pass this bill, even though the money for it has already been appropriated, the government then moved a motion saying that it was unconstitutional, and that motion was then passed by the application of the gag, which prevents debate taking place on the motion. Now, governments are quite shameless in gagging debate. It's an illustration of the principle, if you have the power to do it, you will do it. And governments have that power, and having that power, they will do it. Why waste time debating this issue when we've got the numbers, we can pass it? So let's not waste the time, let's gag the debate. So the debate was gagged on that motion and it was passed. That, to me, deprives that resolution of any legitimacy at all. I have no doubt that in years to come that resolution will be cited as deciding that the Senate cannot pass the sort of bill that was passed on that occasion. Great and learned authorities will say this issue has been decided, and the footnote will say see resolution of the House of Representatives. But what legitimacy can that resolution have when it was passed in that fashion? And of course in the future its legitimacy will be undermined by changes of government when the party in opposition will adopt a totally contrary view to that which it adopted in government, and vice versa. And that will also deprive the resolution of its legitimacy. Still on that same subject of when can the Senate pass a bill and when can the Senate amend a bill, the Senate Procedure Committee set out some years ago a number of proposals which were proposals that the two houses could agree on in relation to money bills, as they're called loosely. And it would be a little agreement about where bills would be introduced, what form they would take, and how the Senate would treat them. And if the two houses could agree on these principles, then this would avoid all these future disputes. That committee report has also never been responded to by governments of both persuasions, and I suspect it never will be responded to, and there never will be an agreement between the two houses, simply because the House of Representatives will not be allowed to even consider the matter because of that government control. Governments will want to keep their flexibility in dealing with these matters and won't want to commit themselves to anything like that. And having their stranglehold over the House of Reps, they will make sure that the House of Reps doesn't agree to it either, and there never will be an agreement along the line proposed by the Procedure Committee. So bicameral relations, there are none. It is a case of the majority of the Senate versus the government. That leads us into all sorts of arguments about the legitimacy of the majority in the Senate. Senator Fielding, by the way, may have 2% of the vote, but he's also got 2% of the seats, which is proportional representation at work. We can have all sorts of arguments about that. But the Senate really has only one legitimacy, and its legitimacy is that it is a control on the otherwise almost total power of prime ministers between elections. And don't forget that the power of prime ministers between elections includes the power to determine how the next election will be fought. If you've got a majority in both houses, you have the power to fiddle the Electoral Act and to determine the terms on which you will stand in the next election to see whether your power is perpetuated. And we have plenty of examples of that. Mm-hmm. So the only legitimacy of the Senate is as a limitation on the otherwise unlimited power of the government of the day, which usually means the Prime Minister of the day. And we can change it in all sorts of ways. We can think of all sorts of better breaks on total power of megalomaniac prime ministers. But we should be careful about abandoning one safeguard until we're pretty sure we've got others of equal, at least equal effectiveness in place. And I think the role of the two houses always has to be considered on the basis of that situation. So I have kept to my time, Mr. Chairman. Within the time, in fact.
Well, you're not a senator.
I welcome the discussion that might follow. Thank you.
Thank you. Coming from a place where in the Senate filibusters are the norm, I'm really very impressed at the self-restraint we've had exercised. We have a brief period of time, so I hope that we will have some questions from those of you who are attending, or perhaps comments from members of the panel about what they have heard. Yes, sir. Please come to the mic.
I agree that with Senator Baum, or former Senator Baum, that any upper house is better than none. You cited Queensland, but I think we should see that where you've got a majoritarian Westminster system, you will not succeed for the reasons that Harry Evans has expounded. And we've got a couple of good examples internationally in Northern Ireland and New Zealand, both of whom could not make a unicameral single chamber work. I think it's quite important, sort of basic situation in political science, a pragmatic position. Around the world, according to Leipart, you've got 11 democracies where you've got a unicameral PR, but your unicameral majoritarian, you only had pre-1996 New Zealand, and of course the catastrophe of Northern Ireland from about 1920 to 1970, I suppose, where that just does not work. And I suppose that it works in Queensland and in the Northern Territory with us because they are actually sub-polities, and that's the only reason they work at all. They're prevented from going totally bananas by the federal polity. So the clerk's comments about the security provided by that upper house is vital. The other thing is that I would agree with you is that the lower house is theatre. I'd see no point in the lower house. I mean, why bother? Why bother having sittings? Sittings could be abandoned. The clerk of the lower house could have a rubber stamp saying passed. It would save us such a lot of money. And I mean, apart from the political point made of the upper house passing some legislation that they know the lower house isn't going to pass, and that generally speaking, the lower house is obedient to the upper house, isn't it? The Senate, I mean. So there's not a lot of point. I mean, the lower house passes whatever the government wants, gets the upper house, there's a lot of argy-bargy, amendments are made, comes back to the lower house obeys. That's a general situation.
Can I respond to that by saying, how do you connect the constituencies that voted for those members in the House of Reps with that particular mandate, unless you've kind of got that activity that's there? That government won't get elected to deliver that unless you've got that connection between the members and their constituency. So unless you have that activity or that theatre, then it doesn't work.
Well, you may say so, but I don't think that 99.9% of the population takes the slightest notice of what goes on in the lower house. And when they do take notice, they take notice of question time, which is pure theatre, and it's not connected to their particular member anyway. Where they are connected to their member is in the electorate office, and the lower house members typically, generally, much prefer to be back there in the electorate where they are connected.
That they do, but they still need that process to connect them to that larger debate. I mean, it doesn't happen by osmosis. You've got to be here and be participating and be exchanging those ideas with the Cabinet and the backbench in order to facilitate that.
Yes, if I could add to that, you and I have a disconnect, and it's not just because I couldn't hear you properly, and that is the best debates exist in the Parliament, in the Parliament building, by within the party rooms where decisions are made. And it's the members of Parliament who in their party rooms discuss in brief and significant addresses the issues. Now, the fact is, apart from members of the parties who like to leak them to the media, those debates where you are aiming at convincing your colleagues are the meaningful debates about legislation.
Yes.
And the outcome, when I talked about theatre, it's the outcome of those debates which are essential. It's the outcome of those debates which are then, if you like, reproduced on the floor of the chamber for the purpose of informing the public what the case is for and the case against. But until the case is determined in the party rooms, your suggestion, well, what's the point?